On this episode of ITAV, John Deere has won an interesting battle with DRM, what that means to the IT and AV space, and Amazon is getting into more spaces, including your car and your conference room, how consultants and designers are making that work. All that and more, next on ITAV.
The network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is ITAV, episode 22, recorded Friday, September 21st, 2018. Tattooed Trees.
Support for AV Nation is brought to you by Kramer, AV Beyond the Box.
This is the ITAV show, the monthly look at how the IT and the AV industry intersect with each other. My name is Tim Albright. I am your host with us to discuss the news of the month. First and foremost, his name is Bradford Ben, and he is the indefensible, incomparable AV industry icon. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Tim. How are you?
I am doing well.
I have to say the Bears finally did win, and I had no Amazon Alexa action planned for that.
You can't plan for every.
I only plan for the likely items, not exactly. Not NASA here.
Exactly. But, yeah.
Yeah. So I apologize for that. Don't worry. I've got the Blackhawks already set up for you, though.
I appreciate that since I'm a Blues fan. All right. Next up is Michael Drainer. He is from Drainer Technologies. Welcome, sir.
Hello, thank you very much. I just want to actually see an icon of Bradford Ben. A little bitty Bradford Ben icon.
Oh, I can go get one for you. I'll send it over to you. Actually, Starin Marketing did that last year with AV Geek Man. You can ask Melissa. It was actually styled after me.
Nice.
It's a true story that I just made up.
Yes. Nice. You look nothing like you. All right.
Thank you.
Last but not least, welcome the new gentleman. His name is Craig Mertens. He is from HGA. Welcome, sir.
Morning.
All right, guys. Here we go. So this first story is actually coming to us from Wired, wired.com. John, the title of the article I want to read is John Deere just swindled farmers out of their right to repair. What on earth do farmers have to do with IT and AV? Here's the thing. Quote, unquote, as anyone who repairs electronics knows, keeping a device in working order often means fixing both its hardware and its software. But a big California farms lobbying group just blithely signed away farmers' rights to access or modify the source code, welcome, of any farm equipment software. That's where this matters. That's where this impacts us. Bradford, I'm going to start with you. This actually comes from a 20-some-odd-year-old law. Yes. John Deere has been fighting this for, has been trying to put this in implementation for quite a few years, and this is the first significant strike against farmers. How does this impact and how will it impact both the IT and the AV folks who are trying to keep their rack rooms, their systems up and running?
So this is something that's near and dear to my heart. This is actually Digital Rights Management, or DRM, and it's being covered under the DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which says that it is illegal to supervent or to circumvent any copy protection, any copyright enforcement tools, and make any changes to software, basically. And this sucks for all of us. So the basics of this story is that John Deere's tractors run on firmware. Everything runs on firmware. My manual toothbrush has firmware nowadays. That's a joke. You're allowed to laugh.
It took me a second.
That's why.
I was a little slow on that one.
Okay, so what happens is that sometimes when there are mistakes or security updates or any of these other things, it needs a firmware update. Sometimes when a tractor goes into a problem and you take out your diagnostic kit and you plug in and you go, oh, I see the problem, let me fix it, John Deere says that's a violation of their copyright. Now, that's most of us will go, yeah, I can see that. They're liable for the vehicle, they're liable for all of this stuff. But the basic thing is I bought the vehicle, I bought the piece of equipment. I'm not allowed to modify it or make any changes to it because that would be violating the DMCA. Now, where this starts to become interesting is for those of us who have PlayStation 3s that wanted to boot or to root them so they could run Linux distributions, that was considered a violation. For those of us who might buy a computer and then install a different operating system on it, theoretically, that could be considered a violation. For updating firmware on a device or making changes to software code, that could be a violation. And some of these are being taken to absurd points, but it's basically true. I'll use Michael as an example because, well, he actually writes code on occasion, unlike me. And if he writes code and he copyrights it and then he puts a password on it, and then say Craig comes in 3 months and goes, oh, well, Michael made a mistake. Let me go in and fix it for you. And types in the password that he may or may not have acquired correctly, Michael can then turn around and sue Craig and go, you've just violated my copyright. Oh, and Craig can actually be put in jail for that. So that's kind of why this sucks. It also stifles a whole bunch of security research for all of us. Because if someone goes in, like say that story we had a couple, I think it was last episode, about a manufacturer's firmware issue and being able to be remotely accessed and manipulated and all that stuff, the security researcher can be considered violating the DMCA Act by going in and making changes to the code to hack it. So now if they report that bug, that deficiency, that flaw, whatever you want to call it, the manufacturer can turn around and stifle it and silence it by invoking the DMCA, which is also bad. And there's also just from me personally, the philosophical level, for those of us who read books or listen to music, remember way back last century when you used to get dead trees bound together with pieces of ink on it, you know, tattooed trees, basically. I could finish reading the book and then I could hand it to Tim and he could read the book and they could hand it to Michael and he could read the book. They can hand it to Craig and he could read the book because I physically owned the hard copy and the rights to share. Through DRM, I can no longer share my book as freely, which has both its pluses and minuses. But the idea is if I own the book, when I'm done reading it, I can't resell it, can't trade it in, can't share it as effectively. It even happens with CDs. It happens with all sorts of stuff. But for us in the IT AV world, the other thing that we have to thank for this is everyone's favorite four letters that are a subset of Mark Coxon's favorite four letters of HDMI. HDCP, High Definition Copy Protection. Once again, digital rights management. So when you plug in an Apple MacBook or some Windows 10 computers into a projector, even though you created the content, you cannot project it because it's not an HDCP compliant item. You're not sending the keys back and forth every 3 seconds. And if you do change your software or firmware so that you can share your content, guess what you just did? You violated the DMCA.
Real quickly, for clarification, if you're not connected to a HDCP compliant display,
no.
If you are, then you can still do it.
No. The way it works is that by default, HDCP compliance is turned on and saying you do not have the rights to share this. The idea being if you have a MacBook, et cetera, and you plug it in and it's a PowerPoint, the HDCP compliant display says, I have no key for this PowerPoint. I will not show it.
Unless you have the key, in which case you can.
How do you get a key for your own PowerPoint?
That's one thing that Microsoft and Mac actually have worked on extensively, that you can plug in. Yes, absolutely.
As long as the source,
and I could be wrong too, but I believe it, as long as the source and the display are both HDCP compliant and they are sharing keys back and forth, then it's the source at that point is the computer.
I think we've had different experiences.
Okay, and that's absolutely possible.
But Michael, it's still an issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's an example of it.
And I have seen it to where it won't show it at all for various reasons as well, depending on what version of HTTP that the source is running or the display is running, because there are different revisions at this point. And if your source is a different revision than your display, there are issues with that as well. Michael, I wanted you to bring this into the server room and clients levels. What does this mean then? If, like Bradford says, you find an issue, how then do you get around fixing it if the manufacturer either hasn't prioritized that yet or just doesn't know about it and they don't see it as an issue, but you and your client in that space and in that specific instance see it as an issue?
So this particular story has multifaceted interest for me because you may or may not know, we serve the agriculture community, very, very large farms across the U.S. And actually one of our largest clients is grows 60% of the watermelons for Walmart and Sam's Club nationwide. So this is a story that we've been hearing about on a regular basis. My big issue with this is it stifles innovation. It stifles innovation from the agriculture perspective because we're running into issues with them being able to develop software and applications that interface with the tractor systems, the GPSs, the machine language that they're running on those platforms to be able to track what's going on in the field. But then that also stifles innovation in the data center because as we start to invoke these regulations, impossible legislation as this moves forward, it's going to stop innovators from creating new methods, new ways of doing things, which means that we have to develop hardware to support our software. Right now, we can use any hardware. So what's this really mean? This means that if I go purchase a server from Dell and I order it pre-installed with Microsoft Windows Server 2016, that this type of, I'm going to call it, I'm just going to call it regulation for our sakes here. This type of regulation is really going to keep us from modifying that device, that software, and supporting our business interest and our business needs and those of our clients, right? excuse me. But what this does play into is it plays into the as-a-service model. It says that, okay, well, you're leasing this hardware, you're leasing the software, we're no longer purchasing licenses. We, the manufacturer, are taking 100% responsibility for it, and you don't have to worry about it, Mr. Customer. So on one hand, it's not a bad thing for business to have that model. It is a bad thing to take away that innovation, take away that right to use, and to stop the end user from developing new methods and ways of accomplishing their goals, right? And we're seeing that not just in the IT industry, but in the ag industry. This is going to affect the automotive industry because the day of the independent shop is going to go by the wayside. There's still independent shops out there. They can still get the software and manipulate the code in the cars to be able to fix them. This is going to take that away, and it's going to become a monopoly to the manufacturers. If you buy a Chevy, you're going to have to go to a GM authorized dealer, period, end of conversation. Nobody else is going to be able to change the spark plugs in that car because they can't manipulate the timings. They're not going to be able to adjust injector timings to fix fuel efficiency issues and filter issues, whatever that may be. So this affects everything across the board. In the server room, that means the ability to modify processor timings and memory speed allocations and whatever the case may be to compensate for custom applications. This is going to have a lot of fallout across the entire tech sector, across all industries.
Yeah, I think there's a missed opportunity here with this entire thing, because you're talking about innovation, the ability to crowdsource, mm-hmm. and there are large communities out in all of these different areas, in agriculture, in automotive, in software, that are willing to go look at the code, improve the code, and as Bradford mentioned, the software is going to become less secure because a huge portion of the security industry is based on independent people attacking the software and coming up with patches and develop, exactly. Identifying those. And, I think the lost innovation and lost upgrades, it ultimately in the long term hurts. I mean, this is free work that's being done to improve these products.
So what's this do to the open source community? Right.
Exactly.
I mean, open source kind of goes by the wayside because you're not going to be able to buy commercial hardware to run your open source software on. when you buy a piece of hardware and it comes with software or firmware or BIOS on it, whatever it may be, you cannot manipulate that.
Well, hang on for a second. Does this not then open up a completely different market to service the open source community to provide hardware that doesn't have anything on it that yes. gives the open source?
It could.
It has.
The business opportunity, right?
That's potentially a business opportunity. When you're talking about agriculture, you know, is a tractor and the all of the work that goes into building a very specific item, is the market there for high precision agriculture? It's probably there for smaller instruments, but you're talking about a really expensive, very complicated piece of equipment that has mm-hmm. a very specific application. Is the overall market available there on that side to develop that open market?
Well, and that's a whole nother, you know, when you talk about that industry in particular, you know, they got pictures of these John Deere tractors on here. I was just in Wisconsin with one of my clients. They've got a tractor that's $1.2 million, right? These aren't things that guys are buying. Even large farmers don't buy these. They lease them. And you know, by leasing that, you're leasing the services that go with it, but you're also not able now to take advantage. Let's put it this way. In the past, if you bought it, you could use it for your purposes, right? You could manipulate the code. You could put ties into it. You could pull precision planting information off of these machines and utilize that with your GPS, GIS data and do whatever you want with it. Develop your own applications. And there was a whole group of people developing applications around these platforms. Well, John Deere is wanting to bring all of that in-house and say, no, you can't use your own GIS software. You can't use your own precision planting software. You have to use ours if you're going to use our device. So does it create opportunity? I say it does, but it's a long road. It's a very long road because the amount of R&D that's already into these platforms, I mean, we're probably looking at 10, 15 years before any type of quote unquote open source ag product can really come to market and be efficient. In the IT space, we could do that much faster. And there is hardware available. I mean, the emergence of the Arduino and the Raspberry Pi and a lot of the other open source product that's out there today has really innovated the IT industry and the IoT industry, if we will, right? But where I see this being an issue is in the larger sense of the big data center, the corporate data center, where we're relying heavily on Microsoft product. We're relying heavily on manufacturers like IBM and Dell. That's going to have to change if those enterprises are going to be able to become more innovative moving forward.
There are still two things
to that as well.
Exactly.
Back to the idea of the Arduino and the boards on the Internet of Things are much smaller, mm-hmm. not as expensive to produce, much more available as opposed to, you talk about a car, even a tractor.
Right.
Those are much larger.
I'll say there are two more things to consider with this, in my opinion. Under DRM and HDC, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, turning off recording and data information and data logging can be considered a violation if the manufacturer has turned it on by default,
right,
a la Windows 10. So now, as an IT person who wants to make a secure boardroom, I have the decision of how do I deal with this? Because it could be that Windows has to go out and say, yes, I'm authorized in a real server and a real piece of hardware once an hour, once a minute, once every 3 seconds, or just the fact that I go in and add my non-approved hardware or software on top of it becomes a violation. And then there's the other thing, which we're all going to laugh about when I make this joke, but I bring this up on a serious note. Pod-based coffee makers, I'm not going to say the brand, have digital rights management on them that mean mm-hmm. you can't use other pods.
Right.
At what point does it become, and perfectly legally, and I'm not saying anyone's doing this, but at what point does someone use DRM and the ability not to change firmware and software and all that stuff to go, this digital product can only talk to this digital product. So now you can't hook up your Sennheiser microphone mm-hmm. to your Apogee channel strip that converts it to USB.
Well, and here's the thing, that's going to take that a step further, right? Because that's a very valid point. Just yesterday, I was in Chicago looking at a project. We're doing some QSIS programming. and it's a big Meijer PA, right? Well, they've got their Galileo in the front of that system, and they were wanting to feed Dante to the front end of the Galileo. Guess what? Meijer will not support that, right? They've got their issues and their reasoning behind it, but that kind of, you know, this precedence sets the tempo for the whole industry to say, you can't integrate your existing infrastructure into our product. We're not going to support that, right? So even if you deliver Dante to another device that would be supported and then drop analog audio into the Galileo, Meijer still will not support that. They will not come out and commission the system till you get the Dante out of the environment. So I use that as an example to say, this sets precedence for manufacturers to say, you can only integrate our product with particular infrastructure or a particular methodology, where today I could plug anything I want into anything I want, right? As an engineer, we're not going to be able to do that in the future if this continues forward.
Well, actually, I think we see that starting to happen, especially in the AV world, across all of these different platforms, where you see all of these manufacturers who are, you know, manufacturers coming from audio who are diving into control systems, or manufacturers mm-hmm. from control systems who are diving into audio and video transportation. You get all of these ecosystems that now, where we once had that ability as, you know, as a designer or as on the user end to say, well, this piece fits this application perfectly, and I want to use this other device because it has these feature sets, and I'm going to pull them together and figure out how to make them work. You start to lose that ability to build systems, and you basically dive in wholesale into, you know, a proprietary ecosystem.
Which is what the manufacturers want.
That actually brings us to our next story, and our last story, honestly. Amazon had a significant product announcement. By the time this posts, it'll be about a week or so ago. The one that I want to point out, but Craig, I want to start with you on this. They're giving folks the opportunity to put Alexa into every car with something called Echo Auto. Now, Amazon Alexa has been available in certain Ford products since last CES. But this is a significant step forward in giving folks the ability to put their Amazon Echo system in cars, in boardrooms. Now, Craig, at what point does Amazon become a significant design concern, a significant design point, when you start putting, you know, they start putting more and more products out there, they start leveraging more and more partnerships like they have with Cortana now, and they start doing their own, you know, Amazon for Business devices? At what point do they become a design concern? And not a concern, but at least a conversation you have to have with your clients.
I would say they're already at a certain level a conversation that you have to have with clients, because you have, you know, you have your audio visual manufacturers out there integrating to Alexa, or you have clients who say, what if I want to be able to walk into a boardroom or a conference room and use my voice to control those systems. You know, so that's already, it's already a conversation out there because it's in their home. So you already have, you know, it used to be that, or perhaps that, you know, the commercial market drove, you know, the enterprise market drove the commercial market. I think it's starting to, there are certain aspects that are starting to flip around there, where you're seeing the commercial market drive the enterprise market, especially in this arena where you're starting to see that come in. And I think there, you know, there are a lot of concerns that personally I have from a design side, where you now have active microphones in potentially sensitive areas transmitting audio to the cloud, and you don't know where that's going. And how do you know, you know, like, and how do we know that we're turning the microphone off when we need speech privacy, or, you know, what other information is going out to the cloud that we're losing out there? You know, on top of that, on this particular subject, that, you know, it's interesting to me from a standpoint of one of the biggest aspects from a control system. I think there's a challenge from an AV control system is the user experience, getting people who don't necessarily know how to use the AV systems to successfully use the control system to bring a boardroom or a conference room up and to get everything working. That's always been a challenge, is to get a non-technical person to interface with have a good user experience with the control system, and potentially voice commands make it happen. But how do you get the people to use the right voice commands? And I think that as the voice command platforms become more prolific, and you get, you know, and they're updating all the time. I mean, as more commands go in and the machine learning happens, they become more user friendly. But then you go back to the whole idea of in the enterprise world, do you want to send all of that speech to a third party? Do you want Amazon knowing everything you're talking about?
Okay, Bradford, I probably know the answer to this, but
no.
Well, I mean, that is kind of a rhetorical question, but you know, that's what it is. I mean, where you need that machine learning on a grand scale to make the voice systems work, don't you? And how do you get that without sharing all of this information with Google or with Amazon or with, you know, whoever it is that's dumping all of this information into their server farms?
Oh, the conversations I've had in my car.
and to Craig's point, Craig is correct that this machine learning does need to get and hear more language and more words to be able to gather more context. Now, there are some platforms that do not have to be in cloud and can be on premises. So it is possible. The security is important. Everyone kind of laughs at me because when I, you know, people are like, well, just turn off Google Maps and it's going to stop tracking you. Yes, it does. But then Google Maps, when you look up, you know, where is this place, or you go to Yelp, or you check in on Foursquare, or do this other stuff, starts putting together your entire map of where you've been. So I just, you know, use Tim's phone instead of mine when I'm out and about. It makes it much easier. But the Alexa in car, to me, is no different than what we have. It's better packaging. And I know that's overly simplifying it, but in my vehicle, I have my mobile device of your choice that happens to have various apps on it, some of which are open source and are basically illegal for me to install on here in theory, and some of which are manufacturer supplied that would say, you know, oh, I can run Alexa on this device. I can run Siri. I can run this. I can run that. And they're all just voice activated at that point. To me, the bigger thing with Alexa's, they've done a better packaging job. Just like Apple wasn't the first MP3 player, Alexa's not the first voice control. It just happens to be the easiest to use. To me, the bigger problem is, from a purely safety driven and someone who rides a motorcycle, I want a car to have a steering wheel, a cup holder, brakes, stuff like that, maybe a radio. No voice control, none of this, none of that. It needs to be simpler, but that's a whole nother diatribe. But to, you know, the Alexa in car, I think, is a natural progression. I think it's going to continue to happen. All they've done is do a better job of packaging what people have hacked together already on their own. Putting an Alexa in a car, if you do a Google search on it or a DuckDuckGo search or take your pick, you can find ways it's been done. If you look at Microsoft Sync, that was there. If you look at Samsung and what they're doing with some of the integration, it's there. So to me, Amazon doing it is nothing new. It's a splash because it's the Amazon ecosystem, not because of the technology. Yeah. Will I use it in my car? Probably not. Is it because I'm cheap? Possibly. Is it because I believe in privacy and I think DRM sucks and I wouldn't be able to adjust it if I didn't like it? Probably much more likely.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see where this goes in the car. What are they going to allow you to control in the car? Are you going to be able to say turn up the heat? Are you going to be able to say roll down the windows?
No, you won't because of this whole John Deere story that we just talked about. They're not going to let Alexa talk to the CAN bus backbone of the car.
And to some degree, he's right.
Hang on, it's Amazon. They're going to have partnerships with every major car manufacturer, unless you're driving a 19.
They will. But they're going to forbid you from writing your own Alexa skill in order
possibly
to interface with that vehicle.
Possibly,
right?
Michael.
But how many of the vehicles already have those skills built in? Like my car, for instance, I hold down the button and say, "Turn up passenger temperature to 78 degrees." And the reaction to that is a unique skill that involves cursing from my wife when she's sitting in the passenger seat, yelling at me for doing that to her again. But
do you know the skill I use? It's called the five fingers on my hand. I reach over and I turn the knob.
Well,
Well, all right, Michael, as we wrap up here, how do you have conversations with your clients if they bring this up? And if you are concerned about, like Bradford said, privacy, and Craig said privacy, and you are concerned about some of these issues, what does that conversation sound like? And at what point do you kind of resign yourself to say, okay, this is what the client wants, now it's my job to implement it?
My job is to educate my client, to inform them of the risks and the capabilities. And it, ultimately, the decision is theirs. If it's something that I'm stark against, then I have a decision to make if I'm going to support that decision or not. There have been a few occasions where we've had clients just sign a waiver that says, hey, we've informed you of the risk associated with this. You've chosen to take this direction. Here you go. Have a nice day. And we carry on, right? I mean, at the end of the day, people are going to do what they're going to do. And we're seeing that over and over again. And as Craig mentioned, the consumer market's driving the enterprise market. You and I've talked about that heavily with Cedia going after the Avixa market and Avixa going after the Cedia market. We're starting to see this real convergence of the two industries. There is no longer going to be commercial and residential. It's all going together. And, you know, people need to understand the risk. As an industry, we have to educate them on those risks that are associated with it. But that requires us to be well-educated and understand, does Alexa actually transmit my voice and my information? What's it actually doing? We need to be able to communicate that effectively to our clients and make them aware of the decision that they're making and the risks that they're taking with it.
All right. That's a good place to stop, gentlemen. Thank you so much. Mr. Bradford, Ben, thank you, sir. How do people find you if they are so inclined?
Well, typically you'll find me on the Twitters making fun of Tim and his lowly bears. However, I do have to remember to put the disclaimer. My conversations and opinions are solely my conversations and opinions. I do not speak for anyone, including my company, my boss, my wife, my friends, my enemies, my dogs. I speak for no one but Tim and myself. And for Tim, it's because I signed his paycheck. But you can find me on the Twitters. You can find me at bradfordben.com. You can go check out my handiwork at avnation.tv, where you can find this and other great webcasts and podcasts available. Plus, as I said, you can see me, you know, on my sites, etc. Every so often, I let Tim run the website. And if it doesn't look pretty, blame him.
Ladies and gentlemen, this PSA brought to you by Bradford Ben.
You can also find his writing and his pretty picture on the cover of SCM this month. So,
yes. I have two articles in there.
I saw that. Yeah, very cool. Mr. Michael Drainer, thank you, sir. How do people find you?
DrainerTechnologies.com, at Michael Drainer on Twitter, but I don't spend much time on Twitter because Bradford Ben is too busy filling up my feed, so I just stay away.
It's not a bad idea. Craig, thank you, sir. It was a pleasure having you. How do people find you or HGA?
HGA.com and the World Wide Web.
All right, very good.
And on Twitter and Facebook as well.
All right, very good. Bradford's not wrong. Don't follow me on the Twitters, although at this point the Bears are technically in first place because the Packers and tied with the Vikings. So technically we're one win, one loss. So, but go by the website if you would, please, avnation.tv, avnation.tv. You'll find this program and a host of others, including our two weekly programs, one that looks at the residential AV market hosted by my buddy Matt Scott, and AV Week, which is hosted by me, post every Monday and Wednesday, respectively. Also, while you're there, check out our underwriter section. These are the folks who help us financially, help us bring you ITAV and AV Week and all the other programs as well. So we thank them for their support. So check it all out at avnation.tv, avnation.tv. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you so much for watching. This has been ITAV.